Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to bridging the gap between adventure and adventurer by helping people select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Michael Bitzer of Catawba College, sitting in for Mike Collins. In the political history of the modern American South, the Southern strategy was devised to turn the solid Democratic South into the solid Republican South. Once a region of electoral blue, the states of the old Confederacy realigned into a sea of red, with some states deeper red than others. This hour, we're going to trace the realignment of the solid Democratic South into the near-solid Republican South, with two political scientists who have written an extensive analysis of that transformation. Dr. Angie Maxwell is the director of the Diane Blair Center of Southern Politics and Society, an associate professor of political science, and the holder of the Diane D. Blair Endowed Professorship in Southern Studies at the University of Arkansas. She has written extensively on Southern politics, including the Indicted South, Public Criticism, Southern Inferiority, and the Politics of Whiteness, which won the Southern Political Science Association's 2015 V.O. Key Award for Best Book in Southern Politics. And Dr. Todd Shields is the dean of the J. William Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences and a professor of political science at the University of Arkansas. He is also the co-author or co-editor of several books, including The Persuadable Voter, Wedge Issues in Presidential Campaigns, which won the American Political Science Association's 2009 Robert E. Lane Award for the Best Book in Political Psychology. Their new book, just out this week from Oxford University Press, is The Long Southern Strategy, How Chasing White Voters in the South Changed American Politics. And both Drs. Maxwell and Shields join us from KUAF in Fayetteville, Arkansas for the hour. Welcome to Charlotte Talks, Angie and Todd.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
Good to have you on. If you'd like to ask about the realignment of the American South politically and its impact on American politics, send us an email to charlottetalks@wfae.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And I want to start the hour with just a basic definition of how you both look at defining what is the Southern strategy. Angie, give us your definition of how you would view it.
Well, the traditional definition, and the one that we've kind of accepted over the years, is that in 1964, when Senator Barry Goldwater gets the Republican nomination, he decides to, you know, really appeal to white racial angst in the South after the Civil Rights Act, which had passed and been signed into law earlier that summer, and try to win Southern white voters who were upset about the passage of that legislation. And so the Republican Party, which had been, you know, on par with kind of the Democratic Party in terms of its, you know, attitudes towards civil rights, really took a fork in the road. And the next election cycle, Nixon does the same thing, though he tweaks it a little bit. And the story is then the South flips from solidly Democrat to, you know, red and Republican. But we have a little bit of a different view on what actually happened.
Todd, you talk about the long Southern strategy as being both geographical and psychological. What do you mean by that?
Well, one of the things we're trying to argue is that when we look at the Electoral College, we're definitely looking at states and regions. Mm-hmm. And the GOP was very strategic in making sure that they had Electoral College victories. But the book is really not just about the South. It's about people that identify as Southern, which goes to explain why you might see a Confederate flag in Wisconsin or in Wyoming or in Portland. So the psychological identification with the South is also just as important as the regional.
Okay. Angie, you talked about the role that Barry Goldwater played in the 1964 presidential bid. And you write that, in fact, in 1953, he wrote in a journal about the potential partnership between Midwestern and Western Republicans and Southern white Democrats at the time. What was his strategy in terms of trying to pull the South, the old Confederate states, into the Republican Party?
Well, Goldwater had seen what the rest of the country had seen in 1948 when Southern Democrats, or many Southern Democrats, had, you know, walked out of the Democratic Party in the convention and kind of formed their own Dixiecrat Party and run Strom Thurmond as a third-party candidate. Mm-hmm. You know, they thought they would do that. It would cause Truman to lose, you know, re-election, and then the Democratic Party would be, you know, come begging back for them to, you know, reinvest in the Democratic Party. But didn't work that way, right? Truman wins kind of without them. And so Goldwater, writing in the 50s, is looking at that saying, this might be a place where we can pick some people off. You know, they're strategizing about the map. It had been such a block for so long for the Democratic Party, the South had been, that, you know, the idea that it could be, you know, kind of cracked or inroads could be made there was a pretty controversial idea within the party. And, you know, Goldwater, when he gets the nomination, has some choices in terms of the way he takes his campaign. But he decides to try to do that. And he goes kind of all in, as do his surrogates across the South. They called it Operation Dixie. Strom Thurmond switches his party label from, you know, Democrat to Republican. He's one of the first high-profile senators that does so. Mm-hmm. And he goes on the stump for Goldwater across the entire South. And the big push they make is that Goldwater votes against the Civil Rights Act, right? And that wins Goldwater, you know, five deep South states. I mean, Mississippi goes 87% for Goldwater, wow. Right? Which is a crazy, you know, flip in a very short, you know, period of time.
Yeah.
But like we said, Goldwater, there's the only states Goldwater wins besides his, you know, native state of Arizona.
Right. 1964 was certainly a pivotal year in American politics. Democratic President Lyndon Johnson, a Southerner from Texas, signs into law the Civil Rights Act, one of the most consequential pieces of legislation in the 20th century. And Goldwater opposed the act. However, many GOP senators supported it. And at the Republican presidential convention, Nelson Rockefeller, who was seen as one of the more moderate to liberal Republicans, attempted to get the party to approve a civil rights plank and listen to the delegates' reaction to his call.
The time has come for the Republican Party to face this issue realistically and take decisive action. It is essential that this convention repudiate here and now any doctrine doctrinaire militant minority, whether communist, Ku Klux Klan, or Bircher.
Todd, that division within both the Republican Party and Democratic Party really started to reshape how the parties were seen, both in the South and in the nation as well, right?
Absolutely. And it's difficult to overstate the fight within the Republican Party. And, you know, the Rockefeller Republicans, as you just heard, were very much wanting to double down on we are the party of Lincoln and we are supporters of civil rights. And then on the other end, you have, particularly in 68, you have Richard Nixon and some of his aides, Kevin Phillips, who wrote the book, The Emerging Republican Majority, saying, no, we're not going to win if we stay the party of Lincoln and pro-civil rights. We are going to win if we go to the South and, quote, hunt where the ducks are.
And Angie, what role did Nixon play? I mean, we've been talking about kind of a continuation of Goldwater's strategy, but how did Nixon continue to define and redefine the Southern strategy?
Well, you know, Goldwater had gone so explicit in his reach for the South that, you know, Nixon's team felt like, you know, you can win the Deep South and lose the country if you don't somehow make, you know, appeals to this white racial, you know, angst and anger more palatable to a general audience. He's also, of course, got George Wallace in 68 to kind of pivot off of. Mm-hmm. He thinks he knows Wallace is going to get the hardliners. And so Nixon really kind of codes and packages that language in terms that, you know, some people were aware of the fact that those were cues about, you know, kind of civil rights enforcement and not enforcing certain legislation, and others, you know, were unaware that those kind of coded language was being used to drive them to the Republican Party. Nixon kind of threads a needle at that point in 68, and he wins, you know, decisively in the South, the states other than the ones that, you know, go for Wallace. But, and this is the part where it's really interesting, is that, and he does the same thing in 72, and that's kind of where we end the story of the Southern strategy.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, we kind of think of that as the short Southern strategy because the South flips right back to Democrats under Jimmy Carter when he runs in 76. And so what we see when you really kind of map it over time is there's kind of a, you know, two steps forward, one step back with the Republican inroads that they make in the South. And so they have to keep evolving the Southern strategy and add different elements to it in order to really solidify that block on the map.
Okay. We've got our first listener comment here. Gerald emailed in, "I grew up outside of Charlotte but spent 15 years working in Washington, D.C. I saw the transition that swept Jimmy Carter out of the White House and his solar panels off the roof. The Republicans courted the South hard with a dog whistle in every tailored suit pocket. At a big Washington event, I asked someone if the GOP knew what it was for. He shrugged and said, 'Votes. Lots of votes.'" What did Reagan in 1980 do in terms of the Southern strategy?
Well, and this is kind of the link. This is the part I feel like has been missed when we look at this overarching long Southern strategy. In 1977, the National Women's Convention was held in Houston. It's the only women's convention we've, you know, ever had. And it was a bipartisan effort to pass the Equal Rights Amendment. Every living first lady of both parties, you know, was in attendance. But mm-hmm. there was a rising anti-feminist movement headed up by Phyllis Schlafly that held a counter rally also in Houston. And their slogan was family values. And Republican establishment kind of and leadership took notice of it. And Schlafly, of course, aggressively promoted it. And Reagan's team ends up polling 40,000 American women. Elizabeth Dole actually helps with that project. And they categorize American women into 64 different types. They called them Nancy. They gave them names, Nancy's, Helen's, whatever. And they realized that, you know, there were just as many anti-feminists, particularly among white women, and overwhelmingly in the South. And so they dropped the Equal Rights Amendment from their platform in 1980. So at another fork in the road, and that was to the dismay of a lot of Republicans, mm-hmm. just like it was in 64 on race, right? They took this, you know, right turn at the fork in the road, and it ended up having the result of a whole lot of particularly Southern white women, anti-feminist Southern white women, flipping to the Republican Party.
Okay. We're going to come back after the break and hear a clip from Elizabeth Dole, North Carolina's own Elizabeth Dole. But this ideal in the last 30 seconds here or so, this ideal of Southern white femininity, how did that, what role was that playing in reshaping the Republican Party?
Well, we talk about, you know, women, white women voters in particular as like this monolithic, you know, thing.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really not. You know, Southern white womanhood, that culture was built to justify, you know, white supremacy in antebellum times. You know, women had to be protected up on a pedestal. And so kind of our construction of white supremacy and our construction of this Southern white female ideal go hand in hand. And that culture is pervasive still.
And we'll pick up with that thought after the break. This is Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that believe a car is used for more than just getting from place to place. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
And welcome back to Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE. I'm Michael Bitzer of Catawba College, sitting in for Mike Collins. And we're talking the Long Southern Strategy with Drs. Angie Maxwell and Todd Shields of the University of Arkansas on their new book out just this week on how the South was politically transformed and its impact on American politics. If you want to join our conversation, you can send an email to charlottetalks@wfae.org or find us on Facebook or Twitter. Before the break, Angie, we were talking about the role of feminism and how Southern white women in particularly differed from what the national movement was undergoing. And you write about one of North Carolina's own, Elizabeth Dole, and her speech at the 1996 Republican convention introducing her husband, then the presidential candidate, Bob Dole. And here's how she framed his candidacy and her role.
I'm going to be speaking about the man I love, and it's just a lot more comfortable for me to do that down here with you. Now, for the last several days, a number of men and women have been painting a remarkable portrait of a remarkable man, a man who is the strongest and the most compassionate, most tender person that I've ever known. The man who, quite simply, is my own personal Rock of Gibraltar.
Todd, you use Elizabeth Dole as kind of an example of the Southern approach to womanhood and the Republicans' approach to garnering this important voting bloc. How so?
Well, in that clip that you just played, you see Elizabeth Dole acting very Southern womanhood and supporting her man and doing it very informally and calmly. And it's interesting that, you know, a lot of people had a very popular reaction to her role there. And then there were calls for her to run for higher office. And then as soon as she did that, the support fell away. And that's a little bit of what Angie has really talked about in the part two of the book, of that we're kind of gone past the era of where we think people say women just can't lead. Now we say women can lead, but as soon as they say they want to, we become really suspicious of them and we don't necessarily trust them anymore. We've seen that not only at the Senate level, but at the presidential level.
Angie, with the dearth of female candidates on the Democratic side, is that still going to resonate in 2020's campaign if one of the Democratic nominees is indeed a woman, and how she would play her campaign to the South?
Million-dollar question, right? I think it does matter. I mean, we measure it with a scale of questions called modern sexism. And like, you know, Todd said, it gets at this, not our belief that a woman can do the job, but a resentment or a distrust. We're like primed to distrust ambition in women and feminism specifically, right? So we have a similar scale when we measure racial attitudes called racial resentment. This is the best way I can explain it, is that when Obama ran, there was a third, about 30% of people who expressed racial resentment that still voted for Obama. On modern sexism, folks that expressed that did not vote for Hillary Clinton. They identified her so strongly with that trigger of resentment, right, towards feminists. But Obama was able to thread a needle. So these female candidates, should they be able to, you know, not attach kind of that, unfortunately, that feminist label to themselves, might be able to, you know, win some voters that, you know, Democrats lost in 2016.
Yeah. What do you think differentiates that Obama being able to thread that racial needle versus Hillary Clinton being unable to do so from a feminine point of view?
Well, I mean, we have 40 years of data on Hillary Clinton. I mean, you know, this is another big difference between Hillary Clinton and Elizabeth Dole. I mean, Elizabeth Dole could not be a more accomplished person. I mean, student body president at Duke, Phi Beta Kappa at Harvard, but she's 10 years before Hillary Clinton, right? Mm-hmm. And that's the contrast in 1996, right, of these potential first ladies, is one that still very much kind of plays that Southern, you know, role, is somewhat deferential, is an advocate for others, and one that is very heavily identified with, you know, feminism and equal partnership. And, you know, some of those things were really poisoned by Phyllis Schlafly's kind of anti-feminist movement. Those labels were really poisoned in the minds of lots of Southern white women and, you know, white women nationally.
Okay. In addition to the issues of race and gender, you talk about the role of religion. Todd, how did religion become such an integral part of the GOP's Southern strategy?
Well, it became part of basically the third leg of the stool in the late 1990s when the Republican Party was saying, hey, we're getting racially resentful Southerners to vote for us. We're getting gender-resentful voters to vote for us, but we're still not holding on to it because Bill Clinton had won in 92 and in 96. Mm-hmm. And so they found another group of voters that really hadn't been supportive of them, and that was the evangelicals and the fundamentalists, particularly in the Southern Baptist Convention. And again, using a lot of data, the GOP decided, hey, if we reach out to this group of people, then we'll have a whole new cohort of the South, kind of the third leg of this long Southern strategy, that would come out and help us basically turn the blue states red.
Okay. We're seeing that play out, in fact, here in North Carolina with the role of religion. And just recently, Lieutenant Governor Dan Forrest, a Republican who is running for his party's nomination to challenge Democratic Governor Roy Cooper, was in Salisbury and speaking to the Cornerstone Church. And he made some comments that have gained some traction in the news.
No other nation, my friends, has ever survived the diversity and multiculturalism that America faces today because of a lack of assimilation and because of this division and because of this identity politics. No other nation has ever survived this. But no other nation has ever been founded upon the principles of Jesus Christ that begin with the redemption and reconciliation through the atoning blood of our Savior. We can overcome the odds because God goes before us to reconcile and to redeem.
Now, Republican Dan Forrest there, Lieutenant Governor, who's running for his party's gubernatorial nomination, pushed back against some of the news coverage about it, saying that his words were taken out of context and that the church, a multicultural church, actually stood up and applauded him. But this issue of us versus them seems to be a key component to the Southern strategy, Angie.
It absolutely is. And you know, we don't hear Republicans start complaining about identity politics and attacking identity politics until we start seeing African American voters vote in a block, right? Mm-hmm. And so then there is this criticism that's identity politics driving that. But honestly, it's the identity politics of the right when they were trying to tap into Southern white identity to, you know, win those voters and change the electoral map that took a position that, you know, is almost impossible for African-American, you know, voters to support when they take that fork in the road. You know, had a Rockefeller, you know, won the party's nomination, it'd be a completely different story. So in that sense, I think he's mixing up what is multiculturalism and what is identity politics. And then the calls for kind of, I mean, the speech goes on really calling for, you know, kind of a Christian nationalism, which is also part of the us versus them strategy, which, you know, has a lot to do with the fact that the Southern Baptist Convention took a fundamentalist turn starting in 1979 and really started pushing not for the freedom of exercise of religion, but for the establishment of Christianity. You know, they fire their lobbying group in D.C. They replace it with one that will advocate. So it's kind of a Christian nationalism. And that is also kind of a pushback to diversity and multiculturalism. And it's a shift. You know, even Goldwater later in his, you know, life wrote about, you know, kind of getting in bed with these, you know, evangelical fundamentalists is going to be damaging to our party, right? So it's complicated. And the Southern strategy evolved to reach those folks. And now there are kind of consequences to that, that, you know, a lot of people in the Republican Party, you know, themselves don't like, mm-hmm. right?
Mm-hmm. I want to get into more of that about the role of evangelicals, particularly with Donald Trump a little bit later in the show. Andy on Twitter, in response to the question, how did the GOP lock up the Southern vote? He wrote, three reasons, crime/law and order, race, identity slash history. And it's this aspect of Southern white identity and identity politics. It almost seems like when you write in your book, that identity is seen as almost a zero-sum game. The loss of white power, increased suppression of the black community in equal measure. Todd, how does that play out in today's politics?
Well, it's, you know, if you think about the South and Angie's first book and the Indicted South, I mean, you've got a group of people who are primed to feel like they've been picked on or have been attacked and have lost, and they have a solidarity among themselves. And, you know, the idea of us versus them is true through the racial part of the Long Southern strategy, the gender part, and then the evangelical part. But the us versus them is portrayed as if this other group of people win, then we will lose. Now, it's maybe vague about what it is actually is you will lose. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's your privilege. Maybe it's your standing. Maybe it's real economic gain, but you will lose somehow.
Okay. You write also in the book, Robert Penn Warren, a famous Southern author in 1956, interviewed a white woman who said, quote, "I can't feel the same way about a Negro as a white person. It's born in me." I thought those four words, "it's born in me," were powerful, Angie, in terms of trying to explain and understand this white Southern identity. How so, and what was your reaction to that?
Well, you know, Robert Penn Warren was doing what a lot of Southerners were doing, just trying to kind of understand what was happening in the moment that he was living. You know, we can see it so differently with the hindsight that we have now, mm-hmm. you know, in the middle of kind of the South realigning. But this born in me concept is such a deep psychological pull to say, you know, your attachment to region. But what's sad about it to me, or what's kind of tragic about it, is when the Republican Party decided it was going to go try to court those Southern white voters geographically, it didn't just do so on these policy stances. That was part of it. Mm-hmm. But it was the spirit and the way in which they did it. You know, the us first. And they tapped into the worst parts of Southern white identity. There's a whole lot of good aspects of Southern white identity that could have maybe, you know, sense of family, sense of place, all of that kind of cultural richness could have been a way, right, mm-hmm. to kind of make people feel more closely identified with the Republican Party. But instead, they, you know, several of their candidates, you know, like I said, to the chagrin of a lot of Republicans, you know, really nationalized the worst parts of Southern white identity. And that has perpetuated some of those elements of Southern white identity by constantly creating this sense of threat, and your way of life is going to change, and there's a war on Christmas, and, you know, just that entire, you know, dynamic. But it does drive votes.
Todd, why do you think the Republican Party chose to focus on the threat thesis, the negativism of the potential white Southern identity platform in their strategy?
Well, I think that, you know, another common theme through all of these three waves is the use of data. You know, the Republicans in the 1960s were way ahead of everybody else in the use of data. And then Angie mentioned Reagan's use of it, and then Karl Rove and Bush's use of it in the 2000-2004 election was just way ahead of their opponents. And the reason they use it is because it works. It is motivating in a way that fear can drive someone to do something that otherwise they might be apathetic. They might decide, well, either one can win. I don't really care. I don't really have a stake in this. But convincing people that, you know, something they value dearly, even if it's ambiguous, is going to change dramatically, can really get people fired up. You know, one of the things we saw that I found really fascinating was we would interview white men who were at the top tax bracket. They were just making enormous amounts of money. And they were the most pessimistic about where the country's going. Their pessimism had nothing to do with really where they are. They're still very privileged and very wealthy, but they're very concerned about where they're going. And that type of something's going wrong plays really well to get people politically active.
Where, Angie, where was that something is going wrong come from? What was at the heart of that perspective?
You know, it's a good question. I mean, you know, Brown v. Board was, you know, they always say sent kind of shockwaves through the South. But, It was the decision, but it was also when we started to actually see federal implementation and federal programs to enforce kind of civil rights, because then it's not an abstraction anymore, right? Mm-hmm. So busing, right? Then it's not
Which
an abstraction anymore.
Which is very much in the
anymore,
news today, right? Yeah.
It's something that's real. It's something that's tangible. It's something that's going to kind of interrupt your life. And we find that, you know, a lot of Americans, the majority of Americans, agree with the concept of, you know, equality of opportunity. But when it switches to we want an equality of outcome, like when you've really got to do boots on the ground programs to make some things happen, it is just an entirely different, you know, ballgame. Mm-hmm. And, you know, 1964, you know, you're looking at a map. You're Republicans trying to go, how do we win? How do we win? Where's the block? Where can we pick off votes, you know, on the map? And they say, you know, the timing of the Civil Rights Act and the fact that Goldwater gets the nomination and he's one of the people that voted against it. And there's arguments about why he did and that it wasn't as, you know, racially motivated, but it's usable in that moment.
Okay. Kirby emails, can any of this woe is me, quote unquote, victimhood be traced to the South losing the Civil War? Todd?
Well, actually, I'm going to defer that one because this is Angie's first book, really. Go ahead.
Okay, Angie?
Well, you know.
Go for it.
Public criticism of the region, you know, the experience of Reconstruction, the experience of, you know, in the 1920s, we've got like five journalists who win the Pulitzer Prize in that decade for like exposés on, you know, Southern racial atrocities and, you know, lynchings and the likes. And so it really creates this defensive, you know, posture. You know, I mean, I grew up in the South. I mean, y'all know this, that kind of exists. Now, tapping into it is a powerful thing. Because what happens is after the Civil Rights, you know, Civil Rights Act, when some things kind of quiet down, you have to recreate and manufacture that sense of urgency again. And that is what pitting people against each other does, right? So when it starts to quiet, I mean, this is what Phyllis Schlafly redefines, you know, feminism as it's not a choice. Like you will have to work. You will have to put your babies in government daycare. I mean, and that really triggers this kind of defensive response that, you know, feminists were criticizing your choice, your way of life, which is actually not what was happening, right? Or that somehow, you know, diversity is attacking your Christian values instead of it just being coexisting. I mean, all of these things are not mutually exclusive. Right.
And we will pick up with that thought after the break. That's Angie Maxwell, the University of Arkansas, along with Todd Shields, who wrote the book The Long Southern Strategy. This is Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE. I'm Michael Bitzer of Catawba College, sitting in for Mike Collins, and we're talking with Drs. Todd Shields and Angie Maxwell of the University of Arkansas and their new book, The Long Southern Strategy, How Chasing White Voters in the South Changed American Politics, out just this week. I want to talk in this segment about the legacy of the Long Southern Strategy, and you write that, quote, many white social conservatives now operate as seasoned politicos. This is also why authentic religious beliefs or credentials are no longer required if a candidate wants to win their support. Candidates who promise to deliver the desired outcome or even simply validate those voters' desires for that outcome is all that is needed. Is that what we're seeing with the continued high support for Donald Trump among Christian evangelical conservatives?
Absolutely. You know, when the GOP started reaching out to evangelicals and the Southern Baptist Convention and the people in the Southern South religious groups, there was a little bit of a litmus test when they became very active in politics. And it's not uncommon now to hear, like we had the clip earlier of a candidate giving a political speech in a church. Mm-hmm. But when they first became active in the late 90s, early 2000s, it was a little bit of a – and even in the 80s when Jerry Falwell ran and the Christian Coalition was making efforts in politics, there was a little bit of a litmus test of, like, are you one of us? If you're one of us, then you have our support. And I think a lot of the South looked at Jimmy Carter and they looked at Bill Clinton, and they were both very openly professing their Baptist affiliation, mm-hmm. They're okay, you're one of us, so we've got your support. That has now changed to where, you know, some people in the South will say, yes, I believe Donald Trump is a Christian, but even Baptists who say, no, I do not think that Donald Trump is a Christian, they'll still very much support him, because now the litmus test is, will you stand for me? Will you fight for me? If you don't believe what I believe, that's fine. Just, are you going to fight for me?
Angie, that change, that shift in theological support to almost a political, partisan, ideological policy support, that's something major within the Republican Party and within religion in the United States, is it not?
It absolutely is. And it's across denominations. And some of it is pulled from the kind of fight over feminism, because anti-feminism crossed all kinds of denominational boundaries and kind of created this unified, group. And when it gets tapped into directly by the Republican Party, at first there is this litmus test, but I think there was disappointment. There's great records on, the disappointment over Jimmy Carter. They really, the South goes back to blue in 76, thinking mm-hmm. this guy's one of us. And when he does not do what they want him, to do and take those actions, they are disappointed. And they realize that instead of just someone who's going to, say they're one of them or even kind of pay lip service, they're going to look for actions. We expect, for some reason, these higher standards that, like, these religious voters are voting completely based on morality, right, of mm-hmm. judging the person.
Right.
But they're really, what everyone does to a degree, they're voting on the issues that are important to them and the person who will do that, regardless of if that person has some kind of authentic, credentials, as long as they will cater to it or, play to it to some degree. The number of people that we surveyed that do not, evangelicals, fundamentalists, who do not believe that, Trump is a Christian, that still vote for him overwhelmingly, is a really shocking and important finding, I think.
And it's not just the South that has changed. I think one of the big right. takeaways from your book is how the Republican Party has shifted. And you write, the long Southern strategy not only tapped into racial and gender role and evangelical angst, it perpetuated it, sometimes even constructing it whole cloth. Over time, that made the party, the Republican Party, Southern, not in terms of place, but in its vision, in its demands, in its rhetoric, and in its spirit. And that has changed American politics. Is that something that Donald Trump has tapped into and continues to kind of push amongst the Republican Party?
I'll just say absolutely. I mean, one of the, kind of signals you can see in that is his, support on Confederate, statues, and his, comments in Charlottesville. And then, 2 months before the election, he gives the eulogy at Phyllis Schlafly's funeral. I mean, this is a deliberate, push. And some of the folks that have worked on these campaigns, like, for example, who runs Reagan's 1980 Southern campaign? Paul Manafort. Who creates the Willie Horton ad, the famous, kind of racialized ad?
Right.
It's Roger Stone and Roger Ailes. Like, there is a contingency of kind of the same consultants that we see common through several of these campaigns. And, there are Republican candidates that have not wanted to do that. Mm-hmm. There absolutely are. John McCain would not play to that hard. Bob Dole, really hesitated on reaching to evangelicals. And those candidates have lost. Because one of the other big findings, and maybe this is, maybe, people know this, but we don't talk about it this way, is that, the people that express this racial resentment or modern sexism or this kind of spirit of Christian nationalism, most people are not all three. Most of these white centers are not all three. They're one of three or two of three. And you have to hit all three to hit those magic numbers that you need to win enough people in the SEC primary, right, as we
right.
call it,
yeah.
to get that nomination.
Okay. Kirk emails, if the Solid South was born from civil rights angst and race generally, where does it go over the next few decades? Does it shift more to a cultural connection than an overt focus on race? Todd?
Well, I think that it's going to be race. It's going to be the three. It's going to be anti-civil rights. It's going to be gender, and it's going to be religion. There might be another wave or another manifestation. It might be on immigration or external threats. I'm not sure, but it will continue to evolve as long as the GOP needs to continue to have that South, because the South voting as a block is such an electoral college advantage that it's very difficult for a Democrat to win without busting up the South in some way.
Okay. I want to ask just a personal question to both of you. What prompted you both to write this book? And what did you discover that you didn't realize, or what was something that you took away that was unknown to you before writing this book?
Well, as a Southern white woman, you know, there is just so little scholarship on Southern white women and their politics. And so that had me digging, particularly when you see, like, you know, and we cover this in the book, but you know, of white women outside of the South in 2016 voted for Hillary Clinton in the majority, but white women inside the South did not. You know, they voted overwhelmingly for Trump. And if you identify as Southern, the numbers are even more extreme, right? And so I've always felt like we have to, you know, break up that, you know, the women's vote and look at it in terms of race, but also look at it in terms of region, because there's almost a reverse gender gap down here, you know, in the South, and what that means and how that's created and what it means for female candidates. And then as digging into that, you start realizing this was part of the Southern strategy. This was the bridge between, you know, playing towards this white racial angst over civil rights and the family values slogan from the anti-feminists that really, you know, kind of started to make inroads with evangelical and religious voters. And so after you dug into Southern white women, I kind of panned out and saw this is an arc we need to talk about, because it explains a lot, I feel like, about, you know, what we're living in.
Okay. Todd?
You know, the surprising thing for me was when we were interviewing people and conducting surveys, people who had, you know, the highest levels of education, and I'm talking about the South or Southern identified people that had very high education levels and then high income levels too, they just felt so threatened that their way of life and that their privileges were going to go away.
Okay. Todd, we talk oftentimes, or we hear about the demographic change in the country and how the country is diversifying. Whites in particular are losing their majority status. Can the Republican Party rely on this strategy in the face of the demographic dynamics and change going on?
I don't think long term. I think short term, they absolutely can. But long term, they won't be able to. With states like Texas and Florida and Georgia, Virginia and others that are becoming much more changing demographics, a different strategy is going to have to be used in order to win those states.
And I want to reiterate again that
please.
There have been Republicans. I mean, there were Republicans who were really, you know, really pushing for, you know, immigration reform and to reach out to Latinos, you know, in the 90s and in the 2000s. Like, there are people in the Republican Party who have been saying, like, this is not sustainable over the long term, or it's sustainable only if you restrict the vote and you gerrymander and you pass voting restrictions. And unfortunately, you know, those folks are kind of being drowned out within their own party. And I hope that, because all of these issues, civil rights, you know, women's rights, you know, the freedom to express and live your own religion, I mean, none of those have to be partisan issues. They don't. They could be supported by both parties. We could argue over what the policy should be to reach certain goals, but we don't have to be fundamentally opposed to it. And that's where this really contributed to our polarization. Because just saying, let's choose sides on issues that you don't have to choose sides on. You can just argue over the best route to achieve your goals. But it has contributed to that, and it's done it in a way that's really personal, so people feel it deeply.
So this polarization that we're all experiencing and seeing in politics, really, it almost feels like it comes back to the zero-sum game, mm-hmm. the us versus them mentality.
Well, you know, it's what's so ironic is Phyllis Schlafly, you know, before she launches kind of her anti-feminist movement, writes a book called Choice, you know, Not an Echo. Mm-hmm. And she encourages Republicans. She said, you just sound like Democratic light. Like, if you really want to win, you're going to have to paint a stark, you know, opposite image. You're going to have to go far to the other side. Because if people can't distinguish you from Democrats, we're not going to win, right? And Goldwater takes that advice. He even uses that slogan, a choice, not an mm-hmm. echo, right? And it's such a shame, because on almost all of these issues, the parties used, their platforms used to be, you know, somewhat indistinguishable.
Okay. Todd, Democrats have talked about targeting the South in their 2020 strategy, especially in suburban South. With the growth of the South, with the influx of in-migration, particularly to states like North Carolina, like Georgia, certainly Florida and Texas, is that a potential strategy that the Democrats can use against the Republicans?
Yes, if they can get folks to turn out and vote. I mean, one of the things that we found is that this us versus them approach, particularly among the large number of people that identify themselves as Southern that live in the geographic South, they are driven to vote. So, you know, a message that's given to this type of a person has a real high return that this person is going to come out and vote for the Republican candidate, even if they supported a different Republican candidate in the primary. Mm-hmm. What we saw in the last election was that Democrats sometimes didn't turn out to vote at nearly the same rates. And then if their particular candidate didn't win in the primary, they didn't go ahead and coalesce around Hillary. They either supported someone else or they dropped out.
And I wanted to say also that, you know, part of trying to kind of part of what we want people to understand of this whole long Southern strategy is it did not happen overnight. It took decades, you know, for the South to realign. And it's going to take a long time for progressives to make the inroads that they want to make. You know, we have 75% of white women in Georgia did not vote for Stacey Abrams, right? Mm-hmm. So those numbers are hard. And rebuilding that infrastructure is exactly what the Republicans did in the South for 50 years and what Democrats have to do, particularly in places that have been dominantly, you know, one-party Republican.
What should the Democratic message be in developing their own Southern strategy?
Well, you know, I'm not big on insult politics. And part of that has to do with, you know, what I said before about people are might be one of those three categories. You know, not all people who express this racial resentment feel that way mm-hmm. about women running or evangelicals and vice versa. And so kind of meeting people where they are, having conversations, not demonizing a whole, you know, lot of people. Politics is still local. You know, that creates a backlash when it's insult politics. You know, that public criticism triggers that kind of vote. And it's just not how we have to do things.
Joe Biden made a comment about when he was on the campaign trail, I believe it was 2 weeks ago, and he said, you know, he's going to win states like Georgia, like North Carolina, and South Carolina, such a strong Republican state. What are the chances that a Democrat would win South Carolina in 2020?
Well, you know, there's a lot of grassroots efforts going on in South Carolina. You know, I mean, Jesse Jackson said he's going to register 100,000, you know, African-American voters. If that mm-hmm. happens, that's a game changer, you know, in South Carolina, because it has such a strong African-American population. So if your voter numbers go, if your turnout numbers go way up, it's, you know, it might be in play. I think Georgia is much more of a possibility, as is Texas and Florida.
We'll see how that plays out. That was Angie Maxwell along with Todd Shields talking about their book, The Long Southern Strategy. Thank you both for the hour.
Thank you.
Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to helping customers select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.